This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Funding Societies is Malaysia's largest peer-to-peer financing platform, providing business financing to SMEs, which is crowdfunded from individuals and institutional investors. Last year, the P2P player disbursed close to 300 million ringgit and has so far disbursed a cumulative 650 million ringgit up to January 2021. Funding Societies is on a regional level has also attracted the eyes of 200,000 investors, with returns ranging up to 14%. But the big question is, are these returns sustainable considering the pressure that SMEs were under over the last year? To find out, I'm speaking with Wong Kar Meng, co-founder and CEO of Funding Societies Malaysia. Kar Meng, welcome to The Breakfast Grill.
Hi, morning. Thanks, Roshan, for having me on the show.
Before we get into the business side of things, and I'd like to take a look at the value proposition that Funding Societies has in Malaysia, right? So retail participation in the stock markets are higher than they've been in years, whether it's Bursa or the NYSE. In this very competitive environment for every ringgit out there, what is your value proposition?
Well, thanks, Roshan. So for us, we are an intermediary between SMEs looking for access to financing to grow their business, to tide them over their cash flow needs. And on the other hand, connecting them to investors, like you correctly pointed out, individuals as well as institutions who may have access funds that they want to invest into SME credit assets. So I think the value proposition that we have for investors is really around ability to invest small amounts into a large number of SMEs, diversifying their risk, at the same time also be able to sort of have very short-term investment tenors compared to longer investment tenors. So in short, small ticket investing available to everyone, as well as having short-term financing investment tenors compared to more traditional asset classes like unit trusts, mutual funds and the like. I think the last point is also, like you correctly pointed out, right now there is a lot of demand and action in the capital markets, and hence the peer-to-peer financing credit assets provide a sort of diversification to their overall investment portfolio.
Right, Kar Meng. Well, a few times there, you reiterated the small ticket proposition, but that is something we're also seeing with a lot of other digital financial services companies that are allowing you to invest into equity markets. And in general, we're seeing a lot of attention being put on the equity markets and the returns that come from there. How are you competing for attention and investor dollars in that kind of space?
Yeah, I think the general trend is really to start serving the mass and mass affluent market through these small ticket investing platforms as being one of them. I think what we, how we view it is basically looking past the sort of short term towards something that's more medium long term in terms of how we would form a part of the investment portfolio of a particular investor. I think that's one of the things that we try to look at, and hence from a diversification perspective, it makes a lot of sense for investors to still have some funds invested across the different platforms out there. I think, so for example, the kind of credit assets and exposure and the risk profile for a peer-to-peer financing platform is very different from, say, if you invest into the stock markets, right? So, and you may not want to have all your eggs in one basket, that's in equities or in bonds, and you want to try to diversify across the different asset classes out there, and us being one of them. I think the other point to consider is also the thing in terms of the different returns profile. So I think even you go investing into the capital markets, you do expect a lot more volatility in terms of capital gains and losses. I think for us, we do look at shorter term, more stable returns, whereby there is a promised interest and principal repayment at a particular point in time over the repayment schedule. Right. So on average, generally, the financing tenor that we provide or investment tenor that we provide is less than a year. So on average, it's probably around 6 months. So I think that provides a very different returns profile to someone who's more interested in, say, the equity markets as well.
As an investor, how do I make an informed and educated decision when you put out a note? Because a banker can go down to the ground and see the business, talk to the owners, and look at the financial statements before they loan a business money. And if I buy stocks, I can look up audited financial statements. What's the scope of due diligence that Funding Societies Malaysia provides?
Yeah. So as a peer-to-peer financing platform, we are required by the regulators to perform the necessary due diligence and risk assessment of all the SMEs that come to us looking for financing before we make them available to the platform investors. So as part of the whole due diligence and risk assessment process, there will be elements that you mentioned earlier. So for example, looking at the financials, looking at the cash flow performance of the business in this current situation, doing virtual site visits and interviews, and having our own internal proprietary scorecard that looks at them, what is the credit worthiness of a particular SME, right? And every SME that comes to our platform would have a differentiated risk and hence return profile. So higher returns for higher risk customers and lower returns for lower risk customers for investors. And we make this information that that we have compiled as part of fact sheet that we provide investors on our platform. So for every investment note, there is a write-up around the nature of the business, the nature of the directors and shareholders, what they are using the funds for, some information around the financials and cash flow, and really what the financing terms are. And investors can then make their own decision of whether to invest or not in each of these SMEs. And they can start from as low as 100 ringgit to minimize any kind of exposure to a particular SME itself.
Do you filter any of the businesses you have on the platform? Basically, like, are there industries that you prefer or types of businesses that you don't allow on the platform?
There are specific industries that we aren't able to serve given the guidelines stipulated by the Securities Commission. But beyond that, we also have industry risk appetite that we review very frequently, especially during the COVID situation and the pandemic, whereby we go down a detailed categories of different industries and our assessment of risk profiles for each of them, whether there's low risk, medium risk, and high risk. And that forms part of our assessment as well in terms of our screening and our risk assessment.
Based on your assessments, over the last 12 months, we've really, a lot of the SME environment or the business landscape has really been shaken up. Based on your own risk assessments, have there been any startling changes in the environment and your own risk rankings?
I think when the whole COVID situation first started, I think we had to make quite a bit of changes in terms of the industry risk appetites. So imagine what MCO 1.0, whereby most, if not all industries, were not allowed to operate for a particular period of time. And that's where we had to make very significant changes in terms of our risk appetite, not just for a particular industry, but really across. And I think the situation has since improved quite dramatically since Q2 last year, right? So when Q3 and Q4 and now Q1 came about, I think we have a better sense of the impact of COVID and MCO restrictions on each particular industry. I think some of the industries that we have obviously been more optimistic about would be things in more counter-cyclical and defensive industries, right? So the essentials as well as the ones that are doing well these days, things like healthcare and what have you. I think certain other industries, things like construction, big scale manufacturing, and whatnot, are some areas that we are still a bit more cautious about. But really, we try not to be too clear cut in terms of industries that we serve or don't serve, but more around taking a risk-based approach to evaluate SMEs in each particular industry.
In amongst the roller coaster that was 2020, overall, was demand better in 2019?
I would say it's probably quite flat compared to 2019. I think bearing in mind that almost one quarter, if not one third of the year, whereby there was very much reduced activity, given the whole restrictions around MCO.
But it wasn't down in 2020, which means you were able to recover some of the demand for the months and weeks that we were not under lockdown.
Yes. So the Q1 2020 was a good quarter for us, coming off of a strong 2019. But we do already sort of noticed a bit of a slowdown in the second half of 2019 because of the trade war between US, China, and the implications on the uncertainty on the local environment. But now, having said that, we did observe a strong 2020 quarter one, before it had a 180-degree turnaround in quarter two. And then it's really improved in quarter three. And then there was a bit of a slowdown in, towards the tail end of quarter four. And hence the term of a bit of a roller coaster. But I think we've been able to sort of navigate and pivot the business to continue serving SMEs even during the whole pandemic situation. So I think that was a good sign for us. I think we've been able to recover to where we were at pre-COVID in quarter four last year.
So when you say pivot, what did you have to do?
Yeah. So I think to the points that you mentioned earlier in terms of how do we revise our underwriting, how do we revise our risk appetite, how do we change the credit policy so that it fits the new normal? Because I think we had to make sure that there is a right balance between SMEs as well as investors, given the situation. So I think we're also quite mindful that investors at a point in time were also a bit worried about how the whole situation will play out for SMEs. And hence, we also had to make some adjustments on that front in order to manage the needs and the concerns of the investors.
The overall default rate for funding societies is, I think, 1.3%. And for Malaysia, it's 3.3%. Why is Malaysia's rate so much higher than the default rate for the platform overall?
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting phenomenon across the three main countries that we operate. I mean, generally speaking, Indonesia has actually the lowest default rate compared to all the other three countries. And I think Malaysia is somewhere in between. And I think the reason there is basically in terms of where the market opportunity is. I think for Indonesia, it's really around being able to serve very good credit customers in very secure structures, but it has to be technically able, right? So that's why that's where the market opportunity is, and that's where we have tapped into. Compared to sort of more developed countries, whereby the competition by incumbent banks are a lot more appealing. So, for example, they're very digital. They're very they focus on all segments. For example, Singapore is a relatively small country, and then you can really reach out to all SMEs across country island wide. So, I think Malaysia is sort of in between, and that's where you see the default rates reflecting that as well, in terms of the kind of segment and SMEs that we're serving.
I've been speaking with Wong Kar Meng, co-founder and CEO of Funding Societies Malaysia. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. This morning, I'm speaking with Wong Kar Meng, co-founder and CEO of Funding Societies Malaysia. We're 4 months into 2021. Are you starting to see a recovery in the default rate and an uptick in overall demand for the financing you provide?
I think definitely there is more uptick. I think it is less of a factor of the COVID situation, but more of a implication of it. So, for example, we have been able to work with partners, and SMEs are increasingly more sort of online now in terms of how they run their business, right? So, and hence that becomes a more natural and a more easily accessible market for us. So let's say when we work with partners, e-commerce platforms, B2B, C2B marketplaces, that becomes a point where, a place where we can reach out to these SMEs that are increasingly digital compared to pre-COVID times. And I think that's where we see more traction, right?
So you're starting to see more traction this year. Is it faster than what you were seeing at the beginning of last year? Because you did say that 2020 quarter one was a strong quarter.
Yep. I think obviously for this time around, we definitely see strong momentum coming out from MCO 2.0. But at the same time also, we are quite cautious as well, because I think the whole COVID situation has not played out fully yet. So we are remaining quite cautious as well. But I think all things considered, it is a very strong quarter for us in terms of beginning the year.
And when we take a look at the competitive landscape, you have some direct competition in the form of CapBay, who in December 2020 achieved a milestone of hitting 100 million ringgit across 500 investment nodes on their platform. Since their launch, this made them the fastest fintech to hit 100 million in P2P financing. Is that speed from CapBay keeping you up at night in terms of the competitive landscape?
I think it's it's actually good news in the sense that it shows the increasing openness and adoption and awareness of digital financing platforms such as us and CatBay and the broader digital financing ecosystem. So I think that's actually good news. And I think if you take a step back and see how big the size of the market is in terms of underserved or unserved SMEs, totaling 80 billion ringgit in terms of financing gap, I think we are really just scratching the surface, right? So even though we have disbursed more than 650 million ringgit, it's less than the 1%, right, of what we observe as being the market opportunity.
Right, and you still expect to hit 1 billion by the end of this year?
Yep, I think we are optimistic based on how we have been able to navigate the 2020, despite the whole COVID situation being in very uncertain territory. And I think we have been able to firm up a playbook for this year. I think we have really explored the different possible scenarios last year, right? So you have quarter two and quarter three and quarter four, which was completely different in terms of the economic environment. And through that period, we have been able to develop a playbook and refine it over time. So I think we are in a much better position this year to manage any kind of curveballs that might come about. So I think hence why I'm still optimistic that we are able to hit that milestone this year.
Now, as mentioned earlier, Funding Societies Malaysia specializes in small, short and unsecured loans. So that doesn't put you in the in direct competition with the banks who do bigger and longer loans. With that in mind, are you then working with banks on being part of their funnel and vice versa? Because you have tenure and access to smaller loans. These companies could realistically grow up and need more funding. Are you working with banks on things like this?
I mean, that is something definitely that we are keen to explore. But also mindful that banks are a lot larger than us. So I think we do see that as a very important partnership with banks, but perhaps more relevant or more meaningful to them when we are much larger.
Right. And you've noted earlier partnerships with Lazada, but you've also partnered with, I think, U-Mobile in the past to disperse your product through their platform. And there are a lot of different fintech players in the scene now. Boost is also in the lending space. Touch and Go has gone into the investment space now. And Grab is looking to get into everything. Are you working on other partnerships outside of U-Mobile?
So we are working on other partnerships as well. So I think one of the other partnerships that we announced and launched last year would be things like Yellow Pages, right, part of TM. And some of the names that you mentioned, Lazada. We're also working with some other e-commerce platforms, whether it's C2B or B2B in the country. And I think for us, that those partnerships have been shaping up. So partnerships generally, from our experience, not just in Malaysia, but across the region, takes a bit of time to build up momentum because of all the intricacies needed in terms of operating model, go-to-market strategy, financing proposition, process flows, and things like that. So generally, they take a bit of time. But I think we have seen it been picking up, especially of Q4 of late. I think this ties back to the whole point around some of these partners are really selling a digital proposition, right? And the whole COVID situation has sort of prompted the move of SMEs towards exploring all these digital propositions. And I think that's where the traction is coming from.
Are you going to be able to announce any new partnerships soon?
Yes, we are looking forward to announcing one or two major partnerships in the coming months. So stay tuned for that.
Are these e-wallet partners or other types of fintechs?
There would be other types of tech and corporates.
Interesting. Now, beyond distribution, all fintechs are kind of looking at the wider financial services industry. Is Funding Society still looking at a digital banking license after the failed bid in Singapore?
We are looking. We are looking at the digital bank license in Malaysia, and we are having ongoing conversations and explorations with different parties in Malaysia. I think generally the whole digital banking framework is something that we see as consistent and synergistic with the business, the peer-to-peer financing business that we have in Malaysia and across the region, which is really to enable access to financing for SMEs And at the same time, also enabling investors to really grow their wealth. I think hence why there is a lot of synergies and consistency with the business model and the competitive advantages and expertise that we have. And we want to sort of see how we can play a part in terms of the whole digital banking sort of framework or the landscape in Malaysia as well.
So when I spoke to Karil Abdullah of Axera Digital earlier in December last year, and they're very clearly going for their own form of digital banking license, they're looking at partners, right? Key partners. They know what they need. What kind of partners are you looking for? Are we talking about technology partners? Are we talking about different product partners?
I think in terms of an archetype of what we feel as a winning consortium, generally there's a couple. So I think the first is naturally the distribution partner. I think if you look at some of the most successful digital banks across the world, I think most of them would be in this part of the world, is whereby they have an existing ecosystem that they can tap into. So that trust, that relationship is already existing and acquisition has already been done, and it's really around tapping into that ecosystem and providing them financial services. So I think that is basically probably the number one key factor in terms of developing a winning consortium. I think if you look at the other types of digital banks across the world, I think there is a bit of a challenge in terms of turning profitable if you don't have the existing ecosystem, right? So I think that's one of the main driver in terms of developing a winning and profitable digital bank. I think the other one is naturally from a capital perspective. So I think very different from any other kind of tech companies. I think from a digital bank perspective, there is much more scrutiny, I would suppose, and expectations in terms of the capital strength of any consortium. So I think the other key driver is there a consortium partner that is able to come in as the capital provider, right? Sometimes they could be the same as the distribution partner. Sometimes they are different. And I think the last piece is really around the technology partner. And when I say technology partner, it's not so much about whether it is the core banking solutions that you're talking about, right? Those are generally quite commoditized and fairly consistent across different providers out there, and you can generally get them off the shelf, right? And I think when I talk about technology partners, it's really around the ability to acquire your customer segments based on your customer value proposition effectively, and also being able to sort of underwrite them and serve them products that they need. And I think that's where we see ourselves as fitting in the puzzle, right? So from a technology perspective. So I think that is the general archetype of what we feel as a winning consortium.
And what is your value proposition in the consortium? Because you're talking about a lot of pieces there. What are you providing to these other partners?
Yeah. So I think for us, it's really coming in from the and final angle that I mentioned. So whether it's in terms of product development, in terms of acquisition, in terms of underwriting capabilities, technology and things like that. And I think that's where we see our value proposition to the consortium.
And do you have a timeline for when you'll be able to announce some progress on this front?
So we are still looking at and speaking to a number of partners at this point. So we do expect to sort of finalize the decision in the next couple of months, one month or so.
Fantastic. To just wrap up this conversation, as of January, you hit 650 million ringgit cumulatively in terms of finance dispersed. You're expecting to hit 1 billion sometime this year. With all this growth in mind, is Funding Societies profitable from an operating standpoint?
Yeah. So we are profitable on an operating standpoint, and that's in most of the countries that we operate in. So two other countries that we operate in are business profitable or operating profitable. I think where we are still investing into is in terms of the technology platforms that we have, in terms of upgrading our systems, cybersecurity, as well as entering into new markets.
Now, I want to end with this note, which I think it's quite a forward-looking one. And of course, I'm sure very aspirational, but this was, I think, Funding Society's co-founder Kelvin Teo has noted before, and I quote, "If we continuously do good work and positively impact SMEs and societies, we'll ring the bell in New York one day." Has there been any talk about a timeline or pathway to IPO?
I think for us, the ability to IPO is generally something that we do aspire to. The ability to do so, not saying that we must do, we must pursue that path. It generally is just a way of capital raising, and has pros and cons. I think the focus there is really, do you have the ability and are you able to build a business that's able to do that? And that's generally something that we aspire towards in the next 3 to 5 year horizon, generally in terms of the scale and the size and the profitability of the business. I think that's what we are aiming towards. I think that is obviously a bit further down, right? As I was mentioning. But I think right now it's really around focusing on deepening our reach in our existing markets. I think there's still a lot more to be done, and I think we'll do well just focusing on what we're doing today. I think that is really just a milestone to sort of align the organization and direction.
Fantastic. I wish you all the best coming. And on that note, thank you so much for joining me on the line today.
Thanks for having me, Roshan. Always a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Wong Kar Meng, co-founder and CEO of Funding Societies Malaysia, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasin for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.